Introduce yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Susan Concannon from Beloit, Kansas. I'm in the state legislature. It's my third term.
We've got a lot to talk with you about specifically, but first we're going to hear the open. This is Statehouse Blend. I'm Sam Zeff. We're using coffee and donuts to help us better understand the historic legislative session underway in Topeka. The issues and the people in the Kansas legislature. Here we go. Joining Susan and me this morning in the KCUR 89.3 production studio is my KCUR bunkie, Dan Margulies, who runs our health desk. Dan, thanks for being here.
My pleasure as always.
Susan, last time you were here, your legislative career was in a decidedly different place. And we're going to talk all about that. But first, I'm looking for an update on your kids, your grandkids, and your corgi.
So I forgot we talked about my corgi. So my kids are Jessica, who lives in Olathe and finishing chiropractic school. My daughter, and she's married to Nathan. My daughter Kelsey lives in Omaha. She's married to Larry, and they have my twin grandsons, Burke and Carter. They're five, and I have a new grandson that's 4 months old, and his name is Bo. Thank you. Then I have a son that's at K-State, and he's in veterinary school.
He was just starting veterinary school last time you were here, yes?
Yes.
Should be finishing up soon, right?
He's finishing his third year.
Good. And the corgi, how are we doing with the corgi?
Oh, the corgi. She has a little sister now, so we have two corgis. We have Stella and Zoe.
Stella, if I remember right, was named after the beer. Am I right about that?
Yes.
Am I remembering that correctly?
You are.
Where'd the second name come from?
She was already named, and we like the name Zoe.
Okay.
A rescue dog?
No, she's not.
Oh, okay.
No rescue dog is named Zoe. All right. Let's move on. I have to say there's an enormous amount of stuff to talk about. And as usual, I don't know where to start, so I'm going to have Dan start.
Great. Well, let me start with Medicaid expansion, because that was just voted on this past week. And on Thursday, the House voted, 8144, that's in my notes, to approve expansion of Medicaid, otherwise known in this state as CanCare. And it would provide health coverage to at least 150,000 low-income and disabled Kansans who don't have coverage right now. So, of course, the bill has to be approved by the Senate, right? And even if it's approved by the Senate, questionable, maybe yes, maybe no, the governor has threatened to veto it. So 81-44 is an impressive margin, but not enough to override a veto. So I have two questions. One, do you think Governor Brownback will, in fact, veto the bill? And two, why do you think he is so adamantly opposed to Medicaid expansion?
I really think that he probably will veto it. I can't live, and Kansans can't live can't be paralyzed by the fear of what he's going to do. I think that we made a really strong statement with over 80 votes on the issue. And to the question of why, I can't answer that. I've tried to figure out why on the tax plan and why with Medicaid expansion. The only thing that I could say is that there's a strong influence from the lieutenant governor, who is a physician, and I think
lieutenant
he advises
Governor Collier.
Him. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have a follow-up question on this, if I may. The bill, correct me if I'm wrong, was originally tabled in your health committee, right? And then you carried it to the floor, right? So you clearly are gung-ho on seeing Medicaid expanded in the state. And, you know, even if the governor, for whatever reason, doesn't veto it, or if his veto is overridden, we now have an administration in Washington that is threatening, and a Republican-controlled Congress that is wanting to phase out Medicaid expansion. So are you frustrated that you finally come this far, the first time it's reached a vote on the floor, possibly to see it die on the vine?
Well, again, I'm just trying to take whatever step is in front of me next. I am a champion of the cause. I have concerns about what will happen in the Senate, what will happen with the governor, and certainly what will happen nationally. But I would say that what happens nationally is the least of my concerns. There are 31 states who have passed expansion, and that gives you 62 senators who are asking the senators and their governors are asking, if you repeal Obamacare, keep Medicaid expansion. And they're talking about the money coming in a different way, in the form of a block grant. And if they do that per capita, certainly we will be hurt by that. So, I just don't see a downside to it. It could change things, but I don't see a downside to the federal money coming.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the politics of how this Medicaid expansion bill got to the floor and what happened there. But before we move on, I just want to have you talk a little bit about, you know something about healthcare. You have a background in that. So talk a little bit about that and how that informs your desire to drive this Medicaid expansion forward.
Well, my husband is a physician. He's a general internist in Beloit. We've lived there 30 years. And so I started a foundation a few years ago that supports the hospital and health projects in the community, and got involved with Kansas Health Foundation through that and the Kansas Leadership Center. And then working with that, became involved with the finances of the hospital, discussions with the hospital administrator, and just sat down and looking at the numbers. You know, as a Republican, I was really upset the way that the Affordable Care Act was pushed through, and I don't like the idea of socialized medicine. On the other hand, when I saw the reality of what it was doing to our hospitals, especially our rural hospitals, for me, there's an impact on the urban hospitals as well. And then what it's doing to the individuals who are caught in the middle. They make too much money for regular Medicaid and don't make enough to be able to purchase on the exchange to qualify for the subsidies. And just the reality of that really pushed me to, when I came to the legislature, tried to have some discussions then with the administration. And I thought, I was very naive. I thought, if I can just show them what this is doing to our small hospitals and how we're going to lose small hospitals.
You say it, you mean the lack of Medicaid expansion.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And when I showed them, they said, we understand the problem, but don't you think it would be better if we had a Kansas solution? And I was, very encouraged, and I said, yes, this would be great. Let's come up with a Kansas solution. We won't expand Medicaid. And here we are 4 years later, 5 years later, and nothing's been done. And we've had a lot of study groups and, looking at different things, but there's been no proposal. This is the program that's funded, and we've turned down over $1.7 billion that Kansans have paid.
Can I throw in a question here?
Yeah.
You made reference to your hospital in Beloit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How is that hospital doing?
Yep. We already had one in Independence and Southeast
Shut
Kansas
down.
Close, right?
Yeah.
So
one in three.
I was wondering that too.
One in three hospitals in Kansas is at risk of closing. We have 84 critical access hospitals in the state, which is more than any other state. My hospital in Beloit is one of those critical access hospitals. It's a lot busier. It's kind of a regional hub than some of them that, have very low census. Our average daily census comes close to 20.
Out of 25 beds?
Yes, they're limited to 25
right.
beds, including ICU, OB. I mean, you can only have 25 beds.
Right.
Our hospital is actually, because of that, does okay. we've got a couple of years where a couple more years where we're able to make some deductions with Medicare that keeps us going. But when those fall off, we're going to be in some trouble if something doesn't change. I don't know how much you want me to get into the weeds with this, but
this is State House Blend, my friend. Weed away.
Well, at one point before the Affordable Care Act, the critical access hospitals were paid 101% of cost for Medicare. And Medicaid at one time was supposed to be equal to Medicare, but it's fallen down to where it's laughable. The problem then came with sequestration, and that 101% dropped to 100%, then it dropped to 99. I think it's 98 or 99 now. So it's below cost. Private insurance companies have decided that for rural hospitals who can't negotiate with them, that they are also going to pay Medicare rates. And then, of course, Medicaid is such poor payment. I don't know what company that you have that can continue to exist operating with, you know, funds coming in less than cost.
But you do think that Medicaid expansion would benefit hospitals like the one in your city?
Yes. Something's better than nothing.
Yeah.
Those patients are being taken care of now for free. The cost all falls upon the hospitals, the providers, The amount that I was told 2 years ago was that $19 million would go to the rural hospitals. And, of course, it's not going to be divided evenly. It's divided up according to how many Medicaid patients they take care of or how many low-income people. But if you just divide it up evenly, $250,000 is huge.
Right.
For those small communities. It would mean being able to hire a new family practice physician or a new state-of-the-art piece of equipment, and it would go a long way if you say $250,000 every year.
I want to talk about the politics of this. As Dan mentioned, you carried this amendment onto the floor. It was bottled up in committee, couldn't get it out of there. I want to talk about the politics about that. I want you to tell me politically how you maneuvered to get it onto the floor. How'd you build the coalition? What was traded? What was offered? So talk to me about that, because I think that was a pretty nifty political trick that you pulled off.
Well, I don't really think it was trickery, but I'll talk about it.
In a good way.
Yeah, right. In a completely good way.
Okay. Yeah. So to understand it, you have to back up a little bit and understand what went on in the committee. When the motion was made to table it, the first motion to table it, it did not pass. The second motion to table it was added until April 3rd. And at that point, the ranking minority on the committee said, we don't know, can we work this on April 3rd? And the committee chairman said, yes. And it created some confusion.
And worked it as a term of art in the committee, where this is where you've had the conferees, people have come in and testified. This is now where amendments are offered, changes might be made. That's what you refer to when
debate,
you say work a bill.
Right. Debate among the committee.
Right.
And we debated it for about an hour, and we were just about ready to wrap up when this last motion to table occurred. It was, to me, a little bit of desperation on the part of the representative that made the motion. But we had three freshman legislators who seemed to have some confusion about it. And the motion is non-debatable. So I couldn't speak up and say, you know, that's not really a very good time. This bill is going to die this week. It was never blessed, which is a term that we use when a bill has touched one of three committees that the it's a sign that the speaker is supportive of it and would like to see it continue on.
Because there are some deadlines, right? If a bill doesn't make it out of committee, it doesn't just hang around forever unless the speaker comes in and says, well, and blesses it.
Blesses it, right. So that deadline was this week,
right.
And that was turnaround. So the vote happened. It did pass because there were people who thought, okay, I can wait till April, and did not understand that the bill then was essentially done for the year. It would be available again in January. So after being very upset about the maneuvers, we had three options. One was to take a vote to pull it out of committee, which would require 70 votes from the floor. Another one was that three people from the committee can request another committee meeting, and we hoped that maybe we could convince one of the people who voted to ask for a reconsider. And then the other one was to have an amendment ready and put it onto a bill that would be considered germane. Eliminated the calling a new committee meeting right away, and just because the way that some of the day went on Tuesday, that the Democrats had brought a amendment for due process that passed, and
this is teacher due process.
Teacher due process, right. Yeah. And so there was a little bit of we were going to try both angles as far as pulling it out of committee and the amendment. So the motion was made, and then we don't actually vote on it for 24 hours. So we had it in motion to pull it out of committee, and then when the education bill happened, there were just a lot of sore feelings, and I just didn't want to be so in your face with the speaker. So I saw a bill below the line that I thought would be germane because it had Medicaid funding. And I went to the speaker and said...
Ron Reichman.
Yes,
from
Speaker
Olathe,
Reichman.
Friend of State House Blend, by the way.
And a friend of mine. And I asked him if we could consider pulling that above the line, which is our terminology to say that we would work it on the floor. The speaker has previously stated that he would not block Medicaid expansion from the mm-hmm. House floor, that we needed to have the debate. He wanted to have that debate this year. So he was cooperative with me. And there was a little bit of back and forth as to which way it was going to go. But in the end, we were able to have the votes to pull that above the line. That required 70 votes, although it just passed on a voice vote, so I don't know how many votes we actually had. And then we were able to work it then on Wednesday.
I want to stay on just purely political terrain right now.
Yeah, I'm real comfortable with that.
We can see.
You know, we gave you a mug. Now she's complaining. With that vote, the Medicaid expansion vote, and the due process vote, and the tax...
And override.
Right. Is that how the politics... It feels to me like we're now starting to see a pattern of how the politics may play itself out, right? You've got a lot of moderates and Democrats in the House that are going to pass things that before wouldn't have had a chance. It feels like it's got a pretty good chance on the floor of the Senate. But when the governor gets involved, are those bills going to be stopped by veto because it can't be overridden in the Senate? Are we seeing that pattern starting to develop, do you think?
Yeah, you might be right about that. I think that we'll eventually get there with the tax. I think that we need to have a couple what I call stinkers come through that are not tax plans that I would support, and a large majority of the House would not support. And at some point, they're going to realize this is the only way out of town because we need to pass a tax plan. on the other issues as far as teachers, you know, with the due process or with Medicaid expansion or a new school formula, those kinds of things, that may become an issue that, but we're making progress. It's better than it was last year, in my opinion.
I want to get back to the tax plan that the governor vetoed this week. And that tax plan would have raised, about $1 billion over a period of 2 years to address the state's huge budget shortfall. So correct me if I'm wrong, about two-thirds of the representatives supported the tax package, right?
Yes.
Okay. And that would have increased income tax rates and eliminated the tax exemption for LLCs and other small businesses. You supported the tax package, correct?
I did.
Right. So now what happens? The governor keeps saying that the tax cuts he championed, the largest in state history, are working to stimulate the economy. All the evidence, of course, suggests otherwise. Mm-hmm. Where do we go from here?
You know, we had in the tax committee, we had the Tax Foundation come from Washington, D.C. and testify. And they talked about what good tax policy is. And we are just the opposite of what pushing it more to consumption tax. And the other thing you didn't mention that was part of the governor's plan was the selling the Children's Initiative Fund money.
Oh, yes.
The securitization of that tobacco money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those are kinds of things that are just signs of desperation of one-time money here and there. And I've been around for a couple of years and seen some of that happen, skipping CAPERS payments and expecting that to happen for the next 3 or 4 years.
You're talking about the pension fund.
Yes. So what happens next? Like I said, I think we'll probably have to run a couple of bills through that are and show that we are serious, that this is what we want to do, and then go back to that first bill.
And you think he'll relent?
I don't know that he will ever relent. I cannot guess what the governor is going to do, but I do think that there will be some senators that could come around, and we will continue to have the votes to override in the House.
They may come around if we can return to the weeds. Senator Jim Denning, who is the majority leader from Johnson County, and Susan Weigel, Senate President, both said that they didn't like the retroactivity part of it. That is to say that pass the tax bill and then that would raise people's rates going back into the past. So let me ask you where you are and where you think the caucus is on retroactivity. Could that get stripped out where it could then have a chance of going through the Senate and overriding a potential veto?
Well, for me personally, I'd be willing to compromise, but it's going to mean cuts. The retroactivity, without the retroactivity, this money doesn't come in until the spring of 19. So, you know,
and we need money now. And when I say we, I mean you, of course, need money now to balance the budget. I mean, you're still about $300 million short. We don't know what the
350, I think.
Well, it's less than that because things, you know, they've been hitting some revenue marks, but we don't know what's going to happen.
Right. But we have a rescission bill that will take us through our fiscal year to July 1st. And then we need to fund the budget for next year. And I think at one point I heard that we were $600 million.
For next year.
Now,
remind me, has the rescission bill made it all the way through?
I don't think it has.
No,
it made it past the House.
Right. So we don't know what's going to happen in the Senate. We certainly don't know what the governor is going to do on this. So there's still some chance. There's still a chance that we could see some K through 12 cuts, not 5% like we had seen earlier, but that there's a potential for that, would you say, or no?
Yeah. No, I think that there's still a chance for those kind of cuts. But if the 84 votes that we had to override, 85, was it, in the end, I think if they stand strong and say, nope, this is what we're going to do, I think it has a chance of going through, just because the House seems to be leading the charge on this.
I want to give Dan one final word, but I have one follow-up question here. We had President Weigel on this podcast a few months ago, where she said in no uncertain terms, this is going to be a very long legislative session. And I'm wondering now that we're halfway through, where you think we are with this. Are you going to be able to get out on time, or are you going to go into overtime? And we now have some markers about, you know, where the political markers are. So where do you think, what are you going to guess?
It's anybody's guess, but I feel like things are moving, and they're moving fast. This session, faster than I've seen in my tenure. But, I think with that said, I think we'll finish on time. I think that we'll get something through. We still have school finance. Mm-hmm. And they're working hard on putting together a formula. And so we'll just see where that comes out. And then, of course, we have a Supreme Court ruling we're waiting on.
Waiting for the Gannon ruling.
And that may trip us up as well.
The elephant in the middle of the room.
Right. Dan, your final thought?
You know, I want to change the subject entirely. And, you know, something that intrigued me about you is that you have introduced in the past a bill to abolish the death penalty, which isn't, I don't think, a typical Republican position. So tell me, do you intend to that bill, I believe, died, no pun intended, in committee. Do you intend to reintroduce it? And why are you opposed to the death penalty?
I don't plan to reintroduce a bill this year. It may come up through one of my colleagues. But I really was up to my eyeballs with Medicaid expansion this year, and there's just only so many of those kind of challenging topics that you can handle at one time. For me personally, I started about 10 years ago rethinking my stand on the death penalty, and then I've read several stories and anecdotal stories of people who have been falsely imprisoned. I don't remember the man's name, but from Topeka, where his brother actually confessed mm-hmm. to the crime, and I was able to meet him last year when we had a rally. Republican aspect of that is that it's actually more expensive to have people on death row, and the medicine, the injection that they receive is it's very expensive. And
very difficult to obtain these days too,
and it has a short shelf life,
right.
So they have to keep that available at all times when they have someone. There's two reasons, but for me, it's more of a personal moral issue.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Very good. Dan Margulies, my KCUR bunkie, and a lot of people don't know, we had to actually push back the taping of our State House Blend episode today because Dan is the preeminent freelance Torah reader in Kansas City. Thanks for coming after your stint at Shul this morning.
Yeah, I appreciate it as well.
My pleasure.
State House Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcast. Do you have the NPR One app? If you do, you can search for us in Explore. Make sure to click subscribe. You can also hear us on UpToDate Tuesdays at 11 a.m. Fan of the Twitter? Bet you are. You can follow me. I'm at Sam Zeff. And my State House Blend Missouri co-host Brian Ellison is at PTS Brian. I'm Sam Zeff. I'll see you around the radio.